It's time for Wisconsin Life. This week, we get an inside look at America's Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee. Here's producer Maureen McCollum.
In 1930, three black teenagers were accused of murder in Indiana. After their arrest, an angry mob dragged two of the young men out of the jail and lynched them next to the courthouse. Then they came for the third boy, 16-year-old James Cameron. Here he is telling his story on WHYY's Fresh Air.
And then they began to yell for me like a favorite basketball or football player. They said, "We want Cameron, we want Cameron." And as the police cleared the path, I looked over into the faces of people as they were beating me along the way up to the tree. I was pleading for some kind of mercy, looking for a kind face, but I could find none. They got me up to the tree, and someone said, "Where's the rope?" They got a rope, and they put it around my neck, and they began to push me under the tree. And that's when I prayed to God. I said, "Lord, have mercy and forgive me my sins." I was ready to die.
But you heard a voice. What did the voice say?
The voice said, "Take this boy back. He had nothing to do with any killing."
Miraculously, the crowd let him go. Dr. James Cameron is supposedly the only person to survive a lynching in the United States. Cameron dedicated his life to sharing his story, the civil rights movement, and eventually landed in Milwaukee, where he founded America's Black Holocaust Museum. The museum's head griot, Reggie Jackson, says Cameron was moved after a trip to a Holocaust memorial in Israel with his wife.
And while they were standing there, they were both in tears, and he turned to his wife, Virginia, and he said, "Virginia, we need a museum like this in America to tell what happened to black people and all of those freedom-loving whites that have been with us along this journey."
He didn't start the museum until he was 74 years old.
That's America's Black Holocaust Museum virtual curator, Fran Kaplan.
He bought a boxing gym for a dollar. He had been collecting for years artifacts that people would send him. Things like Ku Klux Klan outfits that they found in their attics in Milwaukee.
People from around the world came to this small museum in Milwaukee to hear the stories that Dr. Cameron shared. It became really something very unique because it was a telling of American history from a different perspective than the majority of us have ever had.
The museum's doors stayed open in the Bronzeville neighborhood for 20 years. It closed after Cameron passed away in 2006 at age 92.
So we have this exhibit which talks about life in Africa.
The museum has been resurrected. It's housed in a new physical building, but its doors are not open yet. Organizers continue to raise money to finish the displays and create an endowment. Jackson gives me a tour of some of the displays featuring African empires, slavery, and the Jim Crow era.
And as you kind of get further into the museum, probably the most emotional part of the former museum was our simulated slaving ship.
Dr. Cameron's legacy lives on in this new museum.
He said on many, many occasions that the museum is designed to help people. It's not designed to hurt anybody. It's not designed to make people feel uncomfortable. This is as American as any other part of our history.
People are looking to change what's happening in race relations in this country. And Dr. Cameron was way out ahead of this. He emphasized that the truth would set you free.
This man who survived a lynching at the age of 16, who was forced to witness a lynching at the age of 8, found a way to not be a hateful person, found a way to take tragic events that happened in his life and use that experience, those emotions, to grow into a person who wanted to make the world better for everybody.
Go to our website, wisconsinlife.org, where you can learn so much more about Dr. James Cameron's life and the eventual reopening of America's Black Holocaust Museum. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now Reggie Jackson, the museum's head griot, joins us from our Milwaukee studios. Reggie, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me again.
I want to talk about your title a little bit because I think it's an important part of the story. You're a griot, which is a long tradition. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. The docents at the museum are known as griots, and we borrow that name from the oral historians of the French-speaking part of West Africa. They use the word griot to describe the people who are the keepers of the history. And so Dr. Cameron wanted all of the docents at the museum to be known as griots.
It seems like, I'll speak for myself, I have a historical gap when it comes to African-American history. There's slavery and there's the Civil War, and then there's the Civil Rights Movement, especially when it got, you know, it's in the 60s. And then I don't know as much as I feel like I should about that century in between. Do we have kind of gaps in our historical knowledge here?
Yeah, there's a huge gap. That's probably the least known part of African-American history in the country is what happened after slavery ended in 1865 up until Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat in Montgomery, Alabama. And so those years, those decades are really some of the more challenging decades for African-Americans in the country. A lot of really, really horrific things happen that people don't learn about in school. And so they really don't understand the difficulties that we deal with today have been, affected not just by slavery, but by things that happened after slavery. We are aware that slavery ended with the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, but there was a provision in the 13th Amendment that allowed slavery to continue for people who had been convicted of crimes. And so one of the systems that developed was called the convict lease system. And that was a system where black men and children, young boys, could be pulled off of the street, charged with a fictitious crime, and then forced to work with someone for free. And that system was in place throughout the South for many years, all the way through the 1930s. So slavery really existed much longer than we typically been led to believe. There's also a great deal of violence against blacks after the Civil War ended, once the last federal troops were taken out of the South. In 1876, vigilante groups and terrorist groups like the Ku Klux Klan began to really make sure that blacks could not really enjoy those new freedoms they had been given, the right to vote, citizenship rights. And so we began to see a period of violence that really grew tremendously, primarily lynchings that took place across the country, not just in the South, but in the North as well. From 1880 until 1960, there were about 5,000 lynchings that took place. A majority of those victims of lynchings were blacks. It was very rare for anyone to be charged for murdering people in those lynchings. And you also had race riots that occurred throughout the country where whites left their communities and went into black communities and beat, killed people, looted their property, burned their property. The most famous of those is probably the Tulsa, Oklahoma race riot, which occurred in 1921. 35 square blocks of Tulsa was destroyed. It was known as by many as Black Wall Street. It was a thriving business district there. The largest black-owned hotel in the country was there. And so those things are left out of our history classes and our history textbooks. And so people don't really understand what was going on. They don't understand that black GIs coming back from World War II, at least 13 of them were lynched in their uniforms. People aren't aware that here in Milwaukee, that a lynching took place in 1861. And I heard you speaking earlier about the Lady Elgin. That story is actually directly connected to the lynching that happened in Milwaukee. A man by the name of George Marshall Clark was lynched right on Water Street in Milwaukee in 1861. And so the Civil Rights Movement really came out of a lack of understanding by many people of why we needed new laws. We had been given freedom. We had a civil rights law that was passed in 1875. So a lot of those rights that we thought we had, we weren't receiving. And a lot of things happened to, you know, prevent us from moving ahead. There were policies on the state, local, and federal level that prevented us from living in particular neighborhoods and becoming homeowners. The home ownership rate among blacks today is very low as a result of decades of policies like redlining, the use of racial restrictive covenants. And so I always tell people that one of the things we talk about at the museum is that we challenge people to understand why was the civil rights movement even necessary if we had laws in place to protect us. And those are some of the things that Dr. Cameron believed if people understood that history better, that 100 years in particular, then they would understand that, you know, the conditions that we live under today were directly implicated or directly impacted rather by many, many decades of really horrific conditions and bad treatment of blacks throughout the country that really resurface on a regular basis when we have conversations about these things. But we want the people who visit the museum, whether it be the online museum or the physical museum, to understand that the reason we teach this history, the reason that Dr. Cameron wanted people to learn it, was so that we could work on having better conversations about race. We don't have good conversations because people don't know enough. They don't know enough of the history to really have productive conversations. And Dr. Cameron wanted those conversations, people to visit the museum, to leave and have conversations with people that they knew, to work towards one simple goal, to build towards racial repair and reconciliation. We don't believe that you can have repair and reconciliation without truth first, though.
And Reggie, in our last minute, as you work to reopen the museum, briefly, how will you be telling these stories there?
We will have griots at the museum who will be there to give tours. I'm actually working on the curriculum for them right now. There'll also be self-guided tours. We're preparing literature for the self-guided tours at the museum. So it'll be a good experience for people to come and learn, you know, pieces of this history from the exhibits that are there, obviously, but also to have a griot there to answer additional questions they have.
Reggie, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you again for having me.
That's Reggie Jackson with America's Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee with us to talk about what we can expect with the reopening of the museum. You can keep an eye on their website for more information about when the museum will be open to the public at abhmuseum.org. And the virtual tour, of course, is open there as well.